From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. It's always a pleasure to have Dr. Cyril Wecht and Donna Kaufman on the show to talk about their new book, Final Exams, True Crime Cases, from Cyril Wecht, and welcome both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, thank you, thank you for having us.
Nice to have you back on the show. Donna, let's start. Once we get into the book, we'll get into specific cases. We don't want to spoil it for everyone, but a nice foreword by Anne Rule. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we are publishing this book through Anne Rule's ebook company, Planet Anne Rule. Anne Rule, as true crime fans in your audience would know, is the queen of true crime. She's written something like 33 bestsellers. Miniseries, movies have come from her books. So she is my mentor, and her whole team there is just as professional and wonderful as you can imagine. We're very lucky to be part of that, and we consider it a very homey place for us to put our book in front of real true crime connoisseurs.
When you're just joining us, Cyril Wecht, our famed pathologist, is here. He has performed more than 18,000 autopsies and has consulted worldwide on more than 38,000 others. And Donna, of course, is a true crime journalist, friend of the program, with a new ebook called True Crime Cases, Final Exams, True Crime Cases. Dr. Wecht, you must be one of the busiest guys around. When do you get time to sit down and watch a ball game or something?
Well, I am very busy. Fortunately, I want to be in every respect. I have done 8 autopsies just in the past 4 days, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, just in about 4 hours ago. Preparing now for a 3-day JFK 50th anniversary conference at Duquesne University here in Pittsburgh, which will be the largest and best attended JFK conference in the country, with outstanding critic researchers and top-notch people, including Oliver Stone. It's going to be a tremendous program. And then I do my consultations with civil and criminal attorneys, and these deal with medical malpractice, wrongful death, personal injury, product liability, and, of course, homicide. And it is from these homicide cases that Donna and I have pulled out the very interesting cases. And there's still, by the way, a whole bunch left to go. So as long as Donna and I remain kicking alive and intellectually sharp, then we'll be putting out these books. As somebody said a long time ago, the truth is stranger than fiction. And I believe that this plays out perhaps most dramatically and is corroborative of that observation to the greatest extent possible when one looks at cases of controversial deaths, not only involving famous people, people who were famous going in, the people who became famous as a result of the cases like Lacey Peterson and JonBenet Ramsey, who were not known before, or people who were famous before like O.J. Simpson and Phil Spector. But when you get into these cases and you recognize the differences, the basis for the varying opinions as to the cause of death, the mechanism, the manner, the time of death, and so on, then you have some very, very interesting and exciting things. And Donna has just been wonderful to work with, and she has used her vast experience as a journalist and her contacts all over the country, as well as her, how should we say, not shy personality in reaching out to people that she doesn't know. And so we're very proud of this book, as we have been of the others that preceded it.
Absolutely, and I agree with Donna. She is not shy, but that's what makes her such a good journalist. Donna, one of the most touching interviews that I have done in my time on this program was with Mark Lunsford when he was still looking for Jessica. Actually, I had him on the show many years ago, and then after, and it was just heart-wrenching to sit down and talk to him. Share with us a little bit about the girl in the pink hat.
Well, Jessica Lunsford was taken from her bed in Homosassa, Florida in February 2005, and for a while, the dad and his father were looked at as suspects, even though Mark, the dad, said, no way, but you know what, I'll do a lie detector, anything you need, my life is an open book. And it wasn't him that did it. It was a person who ended up going on trial, a complete stranger to the family, who just walked in and took this little baby from her bed. And the way that she died was just unbelievable. And this book goes into, because a lot of people, especially in Florida, know the facts of the case.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to get into those. But what happened to Mark, how Mark went from everyone's favorite advocate for child safety, and to have what the press put him under a real microscope and turned up some things that were unsavory, and you know, just added to his suffering. And so we get into a lot of that, and just how he's come through it all, and you know, just the challenges he faced. But that was a really heart-wrenching case. I wrote about it from the very beginning when she first went missing, and just followed it through the end of the trial and beyond. And Dr. Wecht I brought in because we had hoped there would be a civil suit involved, and we get into all of that, of what went awry in the planning of the civil suit.
Yeah, they were contemplating it, and for a variety of reasons decided not to pursue it.
You know, I was going to ask you, Dr. Wecht, 18,000 autopsies and consulting on 38,000 others. What about the little kids, the horrific crimes like this?
Yes.
You're a family man. It's got to get to you even after all this time.
Of course. There's no question. I'm often asked, you know, how can you handle this and how do you deal with it and so on. It's not easy. You know, I have eyes and the nose, like everybody else. I see and smell what everybody else does, but it's important work and it must be done. The children, the infants and young children, even, you know, in teenagers, these obviously, of course, are the most heartbreaking, because as you say, you know, I've had my four kids and now my 11 grandchildren. I can't help but relate to them, and think about other little kids in their pure innocence. When you see a child that has been battered and fatally injured one way or another, sometimes through sheer negligence, they're not always malevolent, conspiratorially committed crimes. In fact, I'd say most of them are due to negligence, gross wanton negligence. From a legal standpoint, you know, I rise to the level of manslaughter. But the failure of adults to understand the delicacy and the dependency of children is truly mind-boggling. Somehow people never seem to grasp the difference between the needs of a child and the responsibilities that must be manifested by adults for that child, as contrasted in dealing with other adults.
Absolutely. We're here with Donna Kaufman and Cyril Wecht talking about the new book, Final Exams, True Crimes Cases from Cyril. Donna, Cooey's been executed, hasn't he already?
He died before he could be.
Oh, that's right, too. He had cancer.
He just died in prison, which Mark Lunsford had planned to be at his execution.
And right.
Cooey saved the state some money.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, he had a really interesting defense. He sat there, as you recall,
sure.
This trial was on television with a coloring book and crayons in front of him during the trial.
I remember.
Looking like he was a mentally deficient person, and how dare we ask for the death penalty. And then the minute they would go to a sidebar, he would put in the earplug and listen to exactly what they were saying and talk to his attorney. This was an experienced pedophile, an experienced litigant in the criminal system. Wait till you read his previous charges. I mean, it brings up a lot of questions about what do we do with these repeat offenders.
That's for sure. We don't want to give away everything, but the fascinating book, I have read it, scanned through it. The Willing Victim is another interesting section. Donna, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this was a really bizarro crime. I mean, wizened homicide detectives who worked on it will say we've never seen anything like this. And it was from July 2009. There was a wealthy self-help guru named Jeffrey Locker, who would give high-end classes about confidence and salesmanship, and he is 52 years old. He ended up going from his home in Long Island, driving to Harlem, where he found a drug-addicted black guy. Locker was white, and he said, hey, for money, I need to be killed. And the guy said, well, get out of here, go kill yourself. Go, there's a bridge, go jump. He said, no, it has to be for my family. I have all these insurance policies. My whole business has gone belly up. I need your help, and I'll pay you for that. And all you have to do is hold this knife against the steering wheel, and I'll plunge myself into it.
Jeez.
And take all the money in my wallet. And he talked this guy into it because he's the power of, the power of positive speech. This guy who did this for a living, he got this poor schnook to do it. And it went to trial, and it was, the question of was this cold-blooded homicide or was this assisted suicide? And Dr. Wecht testified, and they wouldn't allow him to, Dr. Wecht, please, you talk about this. What the jury wasn't able to see.
Yeah, well, the jury wasn't able to see how this was accomplished, which I think I dramatically and I hope effectively demonstrated on the television program that was done, has been reshown a couple of times, and nothing very difficult to do. I remember the television crew coming in the parking garage right across the street from my office in downtown Pittsburgh, and with my assistant sitting there being Mr. Miner, the ultimate defendant, and I playing the role of Jeffrey Locker, showed how it could be done. And by the way, there was about, what was it, Don? Was it $13 million or $8 million? $12 million worth of life insurance that he took out, a big chunk of which had been paid by a couple of companies, all of which I think has been retrieved since then, and others did not pay because they were suspicious from the beginning. And, when you could imagine when the detectives first heard this story, they chuckled and laughed and thought, oh boy, this is a new unique defense. And it wasn't before long that they came to realize, especially after they went and told the widow and the three teenage children that the husband and father had been found in these circumstances, there was about as much emotional anguish demonstrated as you would show if you walked out and stepped inadvertently on an ant or a spider walking to your car. I mean, there was, and they walked out looking puzzled at each other, and then they delved into it, of course, and all of this unfolded. It's a fantastic story, and this case is now on appeal. Technically, it is voluntary manslaughter because there is no such thing as assisted suicide. I'm not talking about physician-assisted suicide,
right,
which exists in a couple of states in our country and in other countries of the world. But you cannot, no matter what your intentions and how deep your love is, you've been married for 65 years and your spouse is begging you as he or she sits there in anguish and pain and so on, to just help them die, and they can't even physically do it themselves, you're still going to be guilty of manslaughter.
Do you ever sit back, Dr. Wecht, and say, geez, just when I think I've seen everything, here's another case that I never thought I'd ever see?
Right, right. You're right. A fascinating case.
Wow.
That's why we're so lucky that he has 56,000 cases, and I'm the one who has to choose them, and so I go for what I call the twisty mysteries, the ones that have really I can't believe it factors to them, and you know, of course there's plenty more where those came from, but these four are really juicy.
Well, I want to touch, just before I let you guys go, and I appreciate you coming, Dr. Cyril Wecht is here and Donna Kaufman talking about the new book, Final Exam, True Crime Cases from Cyril Wecht, e-book. Your backyard, Dr. Wecht, and we call it Hell Hath No Fury, about Andrew Bagby. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, fascinating case. Donna, go ahead, Donna.
All right. This was in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, small town, in November 2001. Dr. Andrew Bagby was found in a state park, with 28 years old, five gunshots. And he's a physician, a young physician who had the whole world ahead of him, loved by everybody. But he had a psycho girlfriend, and she was also a doctor. So obviously, you know, the attention fell on her. She really didn't have much of a defense, and she fled to her native Canada.
Right.
So this becomes a story of how it took so long for justice. And during the time when she was trying to dodge extradition, she said, "I'm pregnant with Andrew's son." And the baby was born, and he looked exactly like Andrew as a child. And Andrew's parents, Kate and Dave Bagby, gave up their lives in California and moved to Newfoundland to try to be in that little baby's life. And that meant having to bond with the woman that they knew killed their son.
Isn't that
and there are stories that we work on where you go, oh, it's always the man who does this. Men are just inherently evil. Women, poor women. No, wait till you get a load of Shirley Turner, because you've never heard of somebody who has pulled the stunt that she did. And just when you think it's over, it gets worse.
Listen, The book is called Final Exams, True Crime Stories from Dr. Cyril Wecht and Donna Kaufman. Time goes by so fast when I have you two on. I appreciate it. And let's stay in touch. Donna, just tell the folks, how do they get an e-book for those who are saying, what the heck is an e-book?
Well, they could go to Planet and Rule, and you could go to Barnes & Noble or Amazon and put in Final Exams, True Crime Cases by Cyril Wecht, or put in Ann Rule, R-U-L-E, A-N-N-R-U-L-E, presents, and that'll take you right to it, and it's a download, and in 5 minutes you'll have the book, and you'll be reading it, and, you know, cancel whatever you're doing tonight, because this will really grip you. I have to say, the stories are that compelling.
Listen, thank you both. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you
for
having
us. We love your show, Dana. We love you. Thank you.
Take care.
Dana, thank you, Dana. Hope to be with you again.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Donna Kaufman and Dr. Cyril Wecht, famed pathologist. Can you imagine? 18,000 autopsies. He consulted on 38,000 others, and he's not done yet. He did four today. He's one of the experts out there, that's for sure. Speaking of experts, we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with Wendy Murphy. She's a former sex crimes prosecutor. She's a law professor, television analyst when it comes to crime cases. And we're going to talk to Wendy about the laws regarding hazing and bullying. Just in our jurisdiction up here where I live, we've got some hazing charges being laid, and a lot of people just don't understand what it's all about. So we're going to talk to Wendy in just a minute or two. This is the Dana Pritzer Show. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Prentzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. One of my favorite guests is Wendy Murphy. Wendy's a former sex crimes prosecutor. She's a law professor and does a lot of work on television regarding crime and analyzing cases. And she wrote a article for the Patriot Ledger that caught my eye here the other day, Laws Against Hazing and Bullying Hide the Truth. And Wendy, it's always a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Good to be with you again, Dana.
You know, hazing and bullying, even up where I live, we're dealing with a hazing case that has made the media. People our age, and I don't want to sound like we're that old, Wendy, but let's just say me, go back to the old days in high school where we were initiated, so to speak, in grade 9, and that was it was a hazing. I don't care what anybody says, but it's got a lot more difficult and a lot more complicated than that, and both with bullying and hazing laws. You were part of writing some law about this. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many layers to the story, but the purpose of my new piece, which, by the way, folks can get at patriotledger.com, is to expose a pretty ugly and very simple point about both types of laws, and that is that the terminology itself is often used to hide the reality of what's going on, especially with kids, especially at the high school and even in middle school, with regard to these initiations and just social interactions that we too often slough off as boys will be boys or kids can be mean. It's right. Part of growing up, grow your tough skin and so forth. You know, there is a range of behavior for sure that I think runs a gamut from incredibly trivial, such as, you know, calling someone a crude name or, you know, I don't know, let's say spanking them on the leg or in the backside or something, where if you say this is required if you're going to be in our club, or making somebody eat, you know, hot sauce.
Right.
I call those things at the far side of minor when you think about what bullying and hazing consists of. At the other end of the spectrum, you have what recently happened in Massachusetts involving some high schoolers from a town called Somerville. And we've had other problems in similar cities and towns, and you read the papers every day, especially, I mean, how new is a school year? We've only had a few weeks, and already the newspapers are full of stories about similar kinds of activities. And what I mean by, you know, the newsworthy, shocking stuff is, the most grotesque example of which from Massachusetts, again from Somerville, is boys at a retreat in connection with their sports team were at a temporary camp, a getaway camp, where they were supposed to be bonding and building skills as a team so that they would come back to school and win a lot of games. And what they did as part of that team building skill development was literally raped each other with broomsticks.
Yeah.
And there was one boy in particular who was victimized, so I don't want to make it sound like everybody did it and everybody was a victim. Lots of the guys were doing it, but there was only one victim, and he was bloodied, and he was injured, and he was dehumanized, and he was violated in a way that is grotesque in any country, and that except for the fact that it happened in connection with a camp and a sports team from a high school, we would have characterized it as aggravated rape, end of discussion, and they would have all been in lockup and facing prosecution, which, by the way, is likely to still happen in terms of the criminal prosecution. There are charges underway, and the charges include aggravated rape. However, the news reporting absolutely, shamelessly, and I think despicably, wrote the story as a problem of hazing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where my piece really takes off. My argument is very simple. If we're going to have laws against hazing, that's fine. But hazing as a crime is a minor misdemeanor. It carries, I think, maximum 1 year in jail and a fine. Aggravated rape is a life felony.
we have no business describing an aggravated rape as hazing. Similarly, when kids torture each other, and especially when it's sexual, which happens a lot, and it happens disproportionately to girls, it happens disproportionately to girls by both males and females, it is a very clear, very serious violation of civil rights laws, and yet we describe that activity as bullying. And I am sick of it. I am disgusted that I live in a country where every state has laws that allow the wrongful framing of these grotesque activities as something meager sounding, like bullying and hazing. And when we euphemize and minimize with our language, we necessarily raise children to believe that these things they're doing, these things they're hearing about, these things they're reading about aren't that bad.
Wendy Murphy's here, and we're talking about her recent article regarding bullying and hazing. Let's talk about, and it's not always just about sports teams, but there, a lot of them are, the initiations, whether it's a Penn State or sports is what everything is about situation to whatever, a local high school or a cheerleading competition or a whatever. What about that and how the media covers it? Because it's sports, we try to protect. We call it hazing instead of what it really is.
Well, it's I think a combination of things, Dana. First of all, we do love our sports heroes, and it's you know, sometimes it's just a lot of fun to look up to the high school team, to support the team. It's a great community gathering event. In some states in this country, a big college football game is, you know, it's a whole weekend, very happy event where people get together and they celebrate and so forth. And because of the meaning of sports and because of the value of sports, I mean, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars, we do tend to overindulge athletes and we create heroes out of them at very young ages in a way that needs, in a sense, needs some of their bad behavior to be minimized, because otherwise they get in trouble. They go to jail, or they get locked up, or they get prosecuted, or they get kicked out of school. And boy, we can't have that, because if the superstar quarterback gets kicked out of high school, how's he going to become the superstar in college and the superstar in the NFL and so forth?
Yep.
And so I do think that it's, on one level, a very basic moral question. Why are we breeding monsters, and why don't we care? And, you know, a not-so-cynical observer would say, we don't care because when people are worth a lot of money, we turn a blind eye to the bad things they do because we're not willing to give up the money and the value and what that means either to a community or to a sports team or to the fans or whatever. And so I do think what we need at a very basic level is to reconfigure the moral code, reconfigure our sense of balance, and to be very comfortable saying, I don't care if you're the best quarterback on the planet. You are not going to treat another human being like that. And if you do, you're not worthy of our applause. And I really think we have to, because I try very hard to do this myself, and it's not easy, we have to divide our brains and not say, well, I'm okay applauding for him as a football player, but I'm not going to applaud for him as a rapist with a broomstick.
Right.
You know, we did that to O.J. Well, I can respect him because he was a good football player, and I don't respect the fact that he slaughtered two people. No, that's not how morality works. Morality asks a very simple question. Are you okay with the fact that this person, whatever walk of life they come from, committed an execution-style slaying of two human beings? If the answer is no, if you're not okay with that, you can't celebrate or applaud their skills in any other area of life. I feel the same way about Roman Polanski and Kobe Bryant.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, the irony here is that for people like me, we don't even understand the idolatry. I never heard of Kobe Bryant until he was charged with rape.
Yeah,
never
too.
Heard of Aaron Hernandez.
Yep.
And he's from Massachusetts.
Yep.
And he's on the New England Patriots. And I was a New England Patriots cheerleader.
Yeah, I know.
Strangely enough, I know, odd confession moment. But I've never heard of these people until they were charged with rape. Not everybody gives a damn about football and baseball and so forth. Even if we find the nature of the sport fun and we like the activity and we like to go to the ballpark and watch the, you know, watch our team win, if we can't take it down a notch in terms of how much we treat these people like heroes, then we deserve what we get when these younger athletes walk around raping other players with broomsticks and expect that they're not going to get in trouble for it. Then it's our fault.
What about Wendy Murphy's here, and what about Wendy, the parents? Whether they're the parents of someone who is suspected of doing a crime, or they're the parents of a victim, and because of this whole team mantra, this, well, they're just trying to fit in. Oh, well, when I was a kid, I got slapped around a little bit, too. It was all part of this initiation. What about that? How do we educate the parents?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit on the fence about giving too much of the burden to parents. I do think parents take some of the blame. But especially when kids get to be teenagers, parents barely see the kids. You know, they're gone early in the morning. They come home late at night. It's okay to blame other institutions and the leadership at schools and our communities and the lack of law and the lack of law enforcement, lack of politicians giving a damn. I'm not as hard on parents once the kids are teenagers, because I've been a parent of a teenager, and I know how difficult it is to deal with the influences in kids' lives, especially in light of the online world. And it's not that I'm trying to make myself feel better. It's that I've struggled, and it's very difficult to tell your kid not to, you know, enjoy singing disgusting lyrics or, you know, saying inappropriate things or behaving like a monster when all of the influences in their lives when it comes to things like music videos and films and so forth are celebrating violence and celebrating aggression, especially for males. So that said, you know, we do a lot more than we should be doing to create a sense of entitlement among certain kinds of people in society. And it's the entitlement, probably more so than anything else, that fuels the bad behavior. Because, you know, as social animals, especially young people who are still immature, and in many of these cases we're talking about boys whose brains aren't even done developing, if you've raised them to believe that they have the right to do whatever they want, and if you have not raised them to believe that their rights end before they hurt somebody else, then you mix together that sense of entitlement with the impulsivity of a young person, and you're going to get a very bad result. And, you know, the older that kid gets, the harder it's going to be to do the repair work, because the brain will be done. The brain will be done, it will be formed, and it will be subjected to those influences forever. So we have to think about what entitlement means. And to me, it's very simple. As a law professor, and I teach this to my students all the time, we know the basic concept when we learn about criminal law and the crime called assault and battery, that yes, you have a right as a free human being to swing your fist and to wave your arms and to flail your body around and so forth. But your right to swing your fist ends before it hits another person in the nose. That goes for all body parts. It goes for broomsticks. It goes for penises. It goes for everything. Your rights end before you hurt somebody else. And we do not raise people, in the United States of America in particular, we do not raise young people to understand that concept. And when it comes to athletes and other entitled people, which could be athletes, it could be wealthy, you know, children of wealthy families, it could be entitlement from some kind of political influence. It could just be a philosophy that the family has raised their children. It could be a welfare family, a family on public assistance, who nonetheless raises their children to believe that they're entitled to this and they're entitled to that and they're entitled to whatever they want and they're entitled to purchase those $100 sneakers even though, you know, they don't have the cash for it. This sense of entitlement is the very thing that then creates in the mind of a young person the sense that there are no limitations and that there's no value in respecting the dignity of another human being. So for me, to come back full circle now, I think about bullying and hazing laws. You can't, it's like beating up an elephant with a grasshopper. You cannot expect young people to to believe that some piddly little law that forbids hazing under threat of some minor amount of punishment that will never be enforced, and even if it is, it'll be a meager punishment, is sufficient to deter that child, a now growing young man, from acting on impulse and demanding and taking whatever it is that they want, whether it's sex, aggression on the field, aggression in school, aggression in society, violence in the streets, a gun to the head of whoever has what they want. You cannot train an entire generation of people to respect others and to refrain from causing harm if the message that's being sent is, do whatever you want and you can get away with it. And to me, hazing and bullying laws are not only unhelpful, they're hurtful, because they send the message that whatever the underlying behavior is, whether it's rape with a broomstick or something else, that we're going to frame it as this relatively minor problem that we mostly think about as a problem for school kids. It's not really a serious crime. And so long as we just pat you on the head and call it hazing, the world won't think badly of you, and you can go on to your great career as a football player or whatever else in your career that you feel entitled to. And so I'm kind of disgusted. I'm disgusted by the law itself. I'm disgusted by the failure of law enforcement. I'm disgusted most by our failure of leadership. We do not have leadership in this country that gives a damn about the fact that this kind of activity is going on in every state in our country.
Let's finish up, Wendy. There are a few bright spots, like you mentioned in your article. In fact, the Glendale School District has announced something. Let's talk about that before we finish up.
Yeah, very good point. I mean, it is really important to know when folks have reached their limit, and in certain jurisdictions in this country, small pockets of folks are doing more rather than sitting around waiting for law and law enforcement and leadership to step up. Small groups are doing things. And in Glendale, as you mentioned, which is in California, the school district there has taken it upon themselves to start doing proactive monitoring of social media among high school kids. And what I love about this, and I think in the middle school as well, what I love about this policy is that they're getting a lot of heat for it. Oh, you're intruding on children's privacy. You're violating their free speech rights. Oh, no, no, no. This is what I love about Glendale. What they're saying is, if we don't intervene early on when small problems are festering, when little bits of gossip are growing into bigger problems, if we don't intervene early, it's going to be very difficult to deal with the consequences. Moreover, too much harm will have happened. We want to get at the problem of gossip before it becomes the much more serious problem of aggravated rape with a broomstick or whatever that last event is that ends up with the police and prosecutors and the communities up in arms. Good for Glendale, and good for them that they don't give a damn that people like the ACLU and others are calling them fascists and saying they have no business monitoring children's activities. Of course we do. It's not an intrusion on children's freedom to monitor their behavior. They're not done growing yet. It is out of great respect for the fact that they are not yet done growing that we should be intruding into their lives more often and with deeper concern for their futures.
Absolutely. Wendy, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, too, Dana. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Wendy Murphy. She's a former sex crimes prosecutor, law professor, and advocate for victims, and she certainly speaks her mind. Someone else who's a well-spoken individual is Mike McIntyre. Mike hosts a syndicated radio show, Crime and Punishment, in Canada on Rocco and Chorus Radio Networks Sunday nights. He's a true crime reporter with the Winnipeg Free Press, and he's an author of several true crime books. It's always nice to sit down with Mike and see what's been going on in his life, and that's what I did just a few hours ago. I'll share that with you. It's always a pleasure to have my friend Mike McIntyre on the show. He's a crime reporter for the Winnipeg Free Press. Of course, he hosts the ever-popular Crime and Punishment radio show on Sunday nights on Chorus and Rocco radio networks, and he's an author of several true crime books. Mike, how are you?
I'm terrific.
Nice to have
you back.
Nice to have you back on the show. Now, let's talk hockey for a minute.
Now, hockey and crime often intersect, as we saw in Toronto the other day. Some might suggest it was almost criminal what went on the ice, and think fans of the Edmonton Oilers are feeling that way as well after one of their players suffered a pretty gruesome injury after getting slashed in the face with a stick.
I'm wondering, we're going back to the Big Bad Bruins days, the 70s.
1970s, the what were they called? The Broad Street Bullies. Of yesteryear, the Philadelphia Flyers. Yeah, it's now teams are stockpiling goons or super goons, as they're calling them. And, you know, I guess this is true about all elements of life, not just sport, but aren't we all getting bigger these days? And you look at the size of some of these athletes and some of these enforcers on the ice, you know, 6'5", 6'8". It's
crazy.
These are monsters on skates. And it just seems, you know, I'm a big sports fan. I love hockey. I love all sports, baseball, football. But you can't seem to go very far these days without some kind of interaction between sports and the crime beat, whether it's for something that happens on the ice or on the field of play or... how many NFL players have been arrested just in the last year? The number is actually quite staggering, and not just minor stuff. You had a player in New England, of course, accused of a murder. So interesting days for sure.
Well, I think you've just discovered a new idea for a show, Monsters on Skates. You should pitch it.
That would be, you could probably put that on pay-per-view. Actually, there was a guy in Winnipeg a few years ago.
Yeah.
Who decided, trying to take advantage of the fact that he believes people love hockey fights.
Right.
So he actually staged a pay-per-view, and I don't think it did very well, and it was quite controversial. But it was basically hockey fights on pay-per-view. It was a staged event.
Okay.
It's not unlike what you see with mixed martial arts, you know, MMA or boxing. But he got a bunch of hockey goons, and these were staged fights, staged in the sense that there was no build-up to them. They just fought, but the fights were real, and it was broadcast on pay-per-view, and like I said, I don't think there was a hockey fights part two, so I don't imagine it made any money at all. It probably lost money, but interesting that somebody tried to take advantage of that, and of course these days, with all the awareness of concussions and, you know, just saw a major lawsuit settled in the National Football League with their concussion history, the idea of sort of fighting and violence in sport is very much at the fore.
Yeah, for sure. Mike McIntyre's here. I want to ask you, though, and we'll change topics a little bit, about covering stories involving police. Of course, you know I'm a little bit biased when it comes to these sort of stories, but
yeah.
there's lots of them. You know, going back to whatever, in particular with me and Drew Peterson, he's still being referred to as Sergeant Drew Peterson in the some of the big stories. And how do you, as a crime reporter, as a syndicated radio host, when it comes to stories about the cops? Of course, we know what's been going on in Toronto, some stuff in your own home city,
sure.
the Vancouver Taser incident, and stories all over the states. How difficult is it to cover stories about the boys in blue?
Well, there's no doubt, you know, that there's a news value to them, and I suppose, you know, when we take our personal checklist every day to say, am I going to cover this story or not, one of the first things you want to determine, of course, is if there's news value to it. Now, in that sense, you could say, and I would say, that it almost works against police. That is to say, I would cover a case against a police officer that I wouldn't necessarily cover against a regular member of the public. So, for instance, a Winnipeg police officer, let's say, is accused of assaulting his wife. I would cover that trial because he's a police officer, as opposed to Joe Blow charged with assaulting his wife, if there was nothing else to it. Sad to say, but those kinds of cases flood our court system. So police do get singled out, and there's really, you know, I can't make an argument against that. But that's because of the position and the inherent trust and the alleged abuse of power whenever, say, a police officer is charged, especially if it's an on-duty incident. So I get, and that obviously causes some concern. You talk to police officers, they feel like they're treated differently. Now, it's interesting because I often hear from members of the public, especially after trials are over, and there's a feeling that, yes, police do get treated differently, but it's in a positive way. That is to say that it's almost impossible, some people believe, to convict a police officer of anything. Police will make the argument that that's because they're often being charged with things that they shouldn't be put on trial for in the first place. And if they weren't police officers, these cases would never actually get to court. So I guess depending on which side of the coin you're on, there's two very divisive views. But I think as a news reporter, I mean, I have to play it down the middle. I have to rely on, as somebody who covers the courts, what's actually being said in court. Can't get distracted by, you know, outside information or opinion. You have to focus on what's being said, what's the evidence, and play it straight and not allow personal opinion or bias to play its way into it. I mean, truth be told, I have a brother and two cousins who are all Winnipeg police officers. Some, I suppose, could therefore accuse me of having a bias. And yet, I would say that the number of people over the years that have accused me of being anti-police as opposed to pro-police, just based on reporting, is probably 2-1. I don't know why that is. A lot of them are police officers who haven't been happy with things I've reported on. I guess at the end of the day, I feel like I've done my job properly if I have people on both sides angry with me. You're never going to please everybody. And if you've got people on both sides of an issue that are ticked off at you and think that you're being unfair to their side, that's probably a sign that you're actually playing it pretty straight and fair and balanced.
Do you find it difficult because you're not you're just reporting the news? You're actually an investigative reporter where you're trying to get all the sides of the story and putting that puzzle together. Do you find it difficult? Because, of course, the chief is not going to say anything. The spokesperson for the department will, you know, do the generic release. The cops themselves are afraid that they'll sue themselves, so they won't say anything.
Right.
How do you get both sides of the story?
Well, I mean, it can be a little easier if it's at the trial stage, for instance, because that's where you lean on, say, the prosecutor and the defense lawyer. You know that they're going to each put in their case. It will include calling of evidence. For instance, right now, I started just this week, I'm covering it's not a criminal proceeding, but it's a civil proceeding where essentially the Winnipeg Police Service is on trial. And it has to do with a woman who has sued the police. It's gotten out, and it's pretty rare that these things actually get this far down the road, that they're actually now at a civil jury trial where six citizens are going to decide who's right, who's wrong. But, you know, she's alleging that police were heavy-handed in executing a search warrant that actually was aimed at her son, a drug dealer, and that in taking her down at the same time that they took her son down and parading her outside in front of the neighbors in handcuffs and very dramatic entry, the police stormed in. It was the tactical unit. They were wearing masks and had all kinds of weaponry and used a stun grenade to get into the home, break down the front door. She's alleging and is seeking all kinds of damages. So, for example, it's been very easy to cover and get both sides of the story because she was the first witness. She told her story. At the same time, the lawyer representing the police got to cross-examine her. So you got a sense of some of the defense of the police by the questions that were asked. Lawyers also, for both sides, made opening statements to the jury, which was helpful. So you got that contrast right off the hop. Now we're into the evidence where various police officers who were involved in this raid, this drug search warrant raid, are now giving their evidence. So again, you've got their story and they're being cross-examined by the lawyer for the woman. And so when you sit down to write the story, you want to make sure you're including sort of all aspects of the story, not just picking and choosing. People can make up their own mind. That's obviously going to happen. Some people may read my story and say, you know, those bad Winnipeg police officers. Some people may say that money-grubbing woman, and some may be neutral about it. My goal is to at least get the conversation started, give people something to think about, to talk about.
Mike McIntyre's here, and I guess at family functions, you must have to sit at the card table with the kids and not drive.
Yeah, it's interesting, although honestly, the amount of cop talk at family functions is really minimal, and that's, I think, by design. For instance, with my brother, we rarely talk about work-related stuff. I may talk a little more about my job, but I don't ask him about his. I certainly don't ask him about specific investigations or cases he's involved with. And that's by design. I mean, I recognize, as I'm sure he does, that people know who his brother is. People know who my brother is. And the last thing you'd ever want to do is to create the illusion that, that somehow one is working for the other. You know, well, the media and the police, there can be a very good relationship there, and it can be one of give and take. The police often need us in the media to get messages out, to get advisories out, to get assistance in investigations, and vice versa. We as media often need police to fill in some of the blanks, to maybe tip us off when interesting or newsworthy stuff happens. At the same time, you don't want to be seen as sort of arm in arm and, you know, for lack of a better term, in bed with each other. And so I know in the case of family, I go out of my way to not put them ever in a position where somebody could say, well, you must be feeding that McIntyre, you know, this and that. Fortunately, in doing this now for 18 years, my stable of police sources is long enough and significant enough that I wouldn't, even if I wanted to, I wouldn't need to call upon any family for that sort of thing.
Right on. What's next for you? I know you're busy, the radio show and your writing. I'm sure you've got something cooking on the side.
Yeah, nothing, no books in the mix. I've sort of stalled at five. Funny you mentioned sitting at the children's table. My wife keeps bugging me that my next book, after doing five true crime books on very grisly Canadian crime stories over the years, that my next book should be a children's book. I don't think the subject matter and how I spend my days would necessarily translate well to a children's book. It might be quite frightening. I definitely want to write another book. I've actually toyed with the idea of maybe getting into fiction, although, you know, I'm the first that always says fact is stranger than fiction, and it's true. The things that I've covered over 18 years, I couldn't make up the kind of stuff you see and hear on a regular basis. And so I've often been of the opinion, well, why would I even want to try? But, you know, now that I've done enough true crime, there's part of me that thinks probably deep in my head somewhere is a really cool, you know, mystery or crime story just waiting to be unleashed. It might be based on things I've seen and observed over the years. And so I think that's something that probably sooner rather than later I may look at tackling. But for now, crime here in Canada and certainly in Winnipeg, where I'm based out of, keeps me hopping on a daily basis, 3-4 crime stories a day out of the courts. And if you could clone me and make 10 of me, we could probably have 10 times the production. There's that much going on a daily basis.
Right on. Your Jets play my Bruins on Thursday. We're recording this a little early.
Yes, yeah. The Jets versus the Bruins. They actually play Thursday and Friday. Thursday in Winnipeg, Friday in Saskatoon.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a back-to-back sort of situation, the last two exhibition games. So, yeah, if the Jets win, I'll make sure to rub it in your face. If they lose, I'll remind you that it was exhibition and it didn't really mean anything.
Thanks, Mike. Talk to you soon.
Take care.
Bye-bye. That's Mike McIntyre, crime reporter, and, of course, go to MikeOnCrime.com. Listen to his radio show on Sunday nights. He's a good friend of the program. We'll be right back. And that's it. I hope you enjoyed tonight's show. Thanks to all my guests, and we'll see you soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.